do it if we had the finances. So if we grow, we bring our own people in. So those were the three things. I was operating outside of my gifts. We were not seeing people come to Christ, and we weren't discipling our own folks, so there wasn't enough of a foundation to build a strong church upon, and that was why it collapsed. So I was in that season. As I told you, I took that 40 days away. And part of the reason I was frustrated and discouraged and trying to understand what was going on was because every year I would hear from so many different voices, you've got to get bigger, you've got to get bigger. And one of those voices happened to be the person who was in charge of our denomination in Southern California. So every year I would go to our denominational conference, and every year he would give the state of the denomination report, as he should. And every year in that report, there was always a report of, you know, that involved some numbers, as it should be. And every year, a part of those numbers involved this report. He told us every year, over 90% of our churches are under 200, and over 80% of our churches are under 100. And every year, that statement was met with audible gasps of horror. Including from me. Every year, my response was, oh no. And in case we weren't sure that this was something that we should be gasping at, the very next sentence was always some version of, we've got to figure out how to fix this problem. The fact that we had so many small churches was automatically assumed in that room full of pastors to be a problem to fix. And so I'm sitting there as the pastor of one of those 80% small churches, and at times 90%, you know, and I'm looking at it and going, oh no, I'm a part of the problem. I don't want to be a part of the problem. I want to be a part of the solution. But the head of my denomination is telling me I'm the problem. So I got to get my numbers up so that I'm a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. Help me. What do I do here? So that happened every year. And then I took that 40 days away. I came back. I was now beginning to think, what does it mean to define success in ministry without numbers attached to it? And it's just kind of this loop that's playing in the back of my brain subconsciously. I go to that conference again. He gets up again. He gives these numbers again. And after he says that sentence this year, have you ever been in a room where someone's talking and the speaker says something that triggers a thought process in your head that you go off over here even while the speaker is going off over here? And for like a next few minutes, the speaker might as well just be Charlie Brown's teacher because all you're hearing is wah, 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 right? That was me. He said that sentence and I knew the next sentence was going to be some version of we got to fix this. And I just shut down. And that year, instead of responding with, oh no, I responded with, so what? Okay, fine, my church is small. Okay, fine, we got a lot of small churches. I don't care anymore. And something broke in me that year. But I'm stubborn, and when I ask a question like, so what, I tend to want to find out the answer to the so what. So I dug deep, I did some research. And what I discovered was, if you've got a group of churches where 80% of them are under 100, 90% of them are under 200, those numbers do not describe anything about the health of the churches in question. And let me give you one example of how we know that. I want you to imagine that that group of churches is in a period of renewal and revival. When a group of churches is in renewal and revival, a part of that renewing and reviving will involve the planting of new churches. And when we plant new churches, what size do they tend to be? So because we're doing well, we're making more small churches. So if you find a group of churches in renewal and revival and in church planting phase, you will find that percentage. And if you find a group of churches in decline, you will find that percentage. That percentage is shockingly universally common cross-denominationally, cross-culturally, across countries and continents. Almost everywhere you go, something really close to that is the reality. Whether the churches in question are doing well or doing poorly, we always have way more small churches than big churches, which is part of what I was talking about last night, making me think, hey, maybe this is a part of the strategy that God is using and not a problem to fix. If it's happening only in places where the church is doing badly, then we think, well, that's part of the problem. But if it's happening everywhere, including where churches are doing well, then maybe there's something else going on here. So as I was thinking that, I then moved to the third reaction, which was, okay, now what? Now that we know that small isn't necessarily an indicator of a problem, what are we going to do about that? And that, again, now is a loop playing in the back of my brain, not consciously all the time, but it's just kind of there. And one day I was watching Apollo 13, the movie, right? If you haven't seen the movie, it's the recounting of the historical events of what was supposed to have been the third moon landing. Partway up to the moon, they have damage to their vessel. And what was going to be an exploratory mission of the moon becomes a rescue mission. They don't know if they'll get the three astronauts home alive. Spoiler alert, they made it okay. Don't get mad at me. The movie's 25 years old and the events are almost 50 years old. Relax. I say that now because I actually told this story once, and at the end of the session, somebody ran up to me in a panic going, "Did they make it okay? Did they make it okay? You didn't tell the end of the story." So now I tell everybody. And so in the movie, which is apparently a very accurate retelling of the events, they go through one problem after another, until one point they rush into mission control, and he goes, "What's the problem now?" And they go, "They're running out of air filters." And he says, "How did we send them up without enough air filters?" And they go, "Oh, they have enough air filters, but some of them are in the landing module, which they didn't use because they didn't land on the moon, so they've used up all the air filters in the main cabin, or they're about to." And he says, "Well, the landing module is still attached. Have them float over like 10 feet, grab them, bring them to the main cabin, and plug them in." To which he responds, "Yeah, we had them do that. They're a different size and shape. They don't fit into the hole." To which, in the movie at least, he responds with, "Oh, tell me this isn't a government program." Very next scene, a couple of engineers take a couple large boxes of material and they dump them on a huge table in front of all the other engineers. And essentially what they tell them is this: everything that's on this table is everything that's on Apollo 13. So using only what's on this table, you have to figure out how to make this fit into this or they die. And the clock is ticking. Oh, and by the way, there's not a single item on the table designed to do this job. Get it done anyway. I paused the movie. I went, that's exactly what it's like every single day in the life of a small church pastor. Really, Lord, this is the mess you gave me. These are the resources I've got. This is what I have to work with. Yeah, that's right. And the mission hasn't changed and lives are at stake. Get the job done anyway. Every day in the life of a small church pastor. For about 10 years, from I think around 2005 to about 2015, I think, almost every church leadership conference I went to gave quotes out of a book called Good to Great or Built to Last. Two actually very good business books, got nothing to do with the church. And one of the sayings that they always brought out of these books was, you got to get the right people on the bus. When they're talking to pastors, they tell, "Pastor, you got to get the right people on the bus." And what they mean by that is, when you're hiring your staff, that's one of the most important decisions you'll make. And if you get the wrong staff member, if you do the wrong hire, it can take down the whole rest of the staff because one person is in the wrong place. And I would hear this at conference after conference after conference after conference: when you're hiring your staff, make sure you hire the right person, get the right people on the bus. And I'd sit there and go, get the right people on the bus. These are my people. This is my bus. You're acting like I have choices there. When I hire staff, my church doesn't have enough money to hire me. What are you talking about? Don't tell me about how to hire staff. Tell me how to work with my Apollo 13 table mess. Because what you call the wrong people, I lovingly call my church members. Right? Have you ever looked around at your church members and gone, really, Lord, this is who you gave me to work with? I'm convinced at that point, Jesus is just grinning ear to ear going, yeah, did you see the 12 I had? There's no wrong people. There's just people. Right? That's just the way it is. So we just got to deal with what we've been given. So when we start making that mindset shift, we can start, I think, answering some questions in the way they need to be answered, because we're going to be more accurate in the way we're looking at it. So here's an interesting reality. People will come to small churches. Yay! But they won't give up quality to do so. Ooh. Why does that front half of that sentence feel encouraging and the back of that half of that sentence feel very discouraging? Here's why. Because we have a wrong understanding about what quality looks like in a small church. Quality simply looks different in a small church than in a big church. I said it last night. The difference between big and small is not a matter of scale, it's a matter of type. So let's start talking about some of that type. In a big church, for instance, quality is visible and obvious. You can see that mega church from the freeway. You pull off, and when you start up their 1 mile long driveway, there are people holding signs going, "You're awesome. We're glad you're here. Welcome. This is great." And at some point or another, in several of the ones that I've been at, there's a sign saying, "If it's your first time, flash your lights. And if you do, they get you to the best spot in the parking lot." And then they get out, and you've got age-appropriate classes for all of your kids, and you sit in a clean, well-lit sanctuary with the best cup of coffee you've ever had while the band sings songs from their latest album. In a big church, quality is visible and obvious. In a small church, it's a little different. Now, here's the deal. Quality in a small church is not the same as the big church, only smaller. If you try to duplicate big church quality, you're not going to do big church quality only smaller. You will do big church quality only badly. Because that's not what we're called to do. We're a different type of thing. So what does quality look like in a small church? Let me give you just one indication. You can go to that church that I just described, that mega church that I just described. And if it's a healthy church, and it probably is, you can be there for 20 years. You can give your life to Christ. You can be discipled. You can grow in your faith. You can be called into ministry. And you can go off into ministry having been trained in that church. You can receive everything you need, from worship to fellowship to ministry training to discipleship. You can receive all of that in that large, big church for 20 years or more and never have a conversation with the lead pastor. And it's okay, because you're not being pastored by the lead pastor, but you're being pastored by your Sunday school teacher or your small group leader or your Bible study leader. As long as you're being discipled, it doesn't matter that the lead pastor's not doing it. As long as you're getting what you need for your spiritual life, that's okay. That's great. But if you go to a church of 50 on a Sunday morning, you're going to have a conversation with the lead pastor the morning you show up. And if you show up a second time, that lead pastor is likely to remember your name. In fact, here's my first assignment. If you are a lead pastor in a church of under 100, here's my assignment for you. I believe you have a pastoral obligation to meet every single new person who comes in on a Sunday morning. Really, I got to meet every single one of them? Relax, you know there's not that many of them. You can do this. Chill. And then, even more, do everything you can to remember their name. Because if they show up a second time and you remember their name unprompted, they are virtually certain to make your church their home church. Even if you preached badly that week. Because quality in the small church is not about technical brilliance, it's about relational depth. That's what people are looking for in the small church. And in fact, when you ask people who attend small churches why they choose to attend a small church, they give two primary answers. The first answer they give is this: I go to a small church because the pastor knows my name. There's like half the Christians in the world who have this weird desire to be pastored by their pastor. Bunch of freaks. And just sometimes we kind of make them feel that way. Like, if you want to be pastored by your pastor, you're just limiting the growth of your church. Stop. No. If the church does get bigger and the pastor has to pastor in absence, then yeah, we're going to have to make some adjustments. But there's nothing wrong with saying, I really would like to go to a smaller church so that I actually know the pastor, so that the person who preaches on Sunday is the person I can call when someone's sick and is the person who's going to do my mom's funeral. And he's going to know her when he does it. And they're not wrong for wanting that, to wanting to be pastored by their pastor. So don't run away from that. Lean into that. So when we can't try to duplicate the big church experience. We won't, because they can't duplicate our experience. There's nothing wrong with them for not being able to duplicate our experience. There's nothing wrong with us for not being able to duplicate theirs. Each of us should do well what works best in our context. And we need to understand what quality looks like in a small church. So let's get to this illustration. I created this Venn diagram because when I started doing some study on size differences in churches, anytime I read a book, if it had a graphic in it, the graphic was always stair steps or a ladder. Stair steps or a ladder with small churches in the bottom, medium-sized churches in the middle, and big churches on top. And if you see small numbers on the bottom, big numbers on the top, what emotionally does it tell you about the quality of that? What it tells you is bottom bad, top good. Even if that's not what they're intending to teach, that's what that says. So I thought, I want to create a diagram that talks about the differences between big and small without making it feel like small is bad and big is good or vice versa, because I don't believe that. The Venn diagram takes care of that, and here's how it works. The smaller your church is, the less overlap you will have with our big church friends. And the bigger your church gets, the more overlap you will have with our big church friends. It's not better, worse, top, bottom. It's less overlap, more overlap. That's all. That's why if you've ever gone to a conference, if you pastor a very small church and you've gone to a typical church leadership conference and you've walked out going, I got nothing. I don't know if I can use any of that at home. And maybe you've got a friend who pastors a church of even 300 and they walk out going, I got so much out of that. We can do this. We can do this. We can do this. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be great. You know, again, you're like I said last night, you're wondering, am I stupid? Or are they wrong? Or no, they're not wrong. You're not stupid. It's just that your friend who pastors a church of 300 has a lot more overlap with what was said than you do. They're speaking from that left circle. And if you don't have much overlap with that left circle, there's not much they say that's going to be able to help you. And the bigger you get, the more help you're going to find from the typical places we go for pastoral leadership, especially in the years after Bible college. The bottom line is that, you know, many big church principles simply don't translate well into a small church context because it's not just a difference of scale, it's a difference of type. It's a different type of church. All right, the reason for this I'm going to do one more thing. So here's what I've discovered. In a small church, if you are a small church pastor, leader of some type, there are three different skill sets that you need to understand. The first skill set is the overlap between the circles. There are some principles that apply in all churches, in all places, at all times. That's typically what you're going to learn in Bible college or seminary. You're going to come out with an understanding of universal church principles. We need to know what those things are. They'll apply in every church. Then you need to understand that circle on the right, which is, okay, what things now are small church specific? Things that only work in small churches that are different than the way they work in big churches. We need to start understanding that. That's what my ministry is all about. But there's precious little teaching about it. We're not taught that that is even possible, let alone what some of those things are, very often at all. But even after you do that, there's something left over. So I've added these circles. You'll notice something about them. First of all, they're only on the part of the small church circle that does not overlap with our big church friends, because this is a small church phenomenon. They're different colors, sizes, and so on. And they also don't touch each other, and here's why. If the middle stands for things that all churches have in common, and the right circle stands for all the things that all small churches have in common, these little circles are the leftover part where your church is different from any other church on the face of the earth. This is the why is my church so weird part that I promised last night, okay? And here's the deal. The smaller your church is, the bigger your unique circle will be. So if you've got two big churches, even if they're like very different in size. If you got a church of 20,000, let's talk about super mega. If you got a church of 20,000 and a church of 2,000, they're 10 times difference in size, but their circles virtually overlap because they're both big. They are of the same type. It's just a matter of scale, right? But if you're talking smaller churches, and if you're down to a church of 200, if you're down to a church of 50, down to a church of 20, then all of a sudden you're going to look around and go, okay, there are some things that we do that all churches do. There are some things that we do that all small churches do. And then there's this leftover weird part that only we do. How do I manage that? And the reason for that is because in larger churches, there's something called the law of large numbers that kicks in. The law of large numbers is a sociological phenomenon that says that the bigger a crowd is, the more predictably they behave. This is how every polling company works. So if Gallup wants to survey Americans about how they feel about such and such, have you ever seen one of those polls? Americans say this about such and such, and you go, nobody talked to me. Here's the deal. They don't need to talk to you or to me. If they do three things right, they'll get a good survey. One, they have to ask the right kind of question. Two, they have to ask a good demographic mix of people. And thirdly, they have to ask what's called minimum sample size. Minimum sample size. That means you can't survey just 100 people and then go, that's what 300 million say. No, you've got to do something like 30,000 people, and then you can add some zeros, and then you'll be accurate. You have to have minimum sample size. So I want you to imagine that you pastor a church of 2,000. You go into a conference where the speaker is pastoring a church of 20,000. Virtually everything that that person says they do in their church, you can do in your church, just drop a zero and you're good to go. But they're 10 times bigger, I know, but you're both above minimum sample size. You're of the same type, it's just a matter of scale. As an example, Shelley and I were at a conference at a mega church years ago, and we got there late, and we had to park way in the back, like, I think we can see the building from here. And we thought, we're going to take forever to walk there. We're going to get there late. Before we got out of the car, a friendly person drove up in a golf cart and said, let me drive you to the front door. And so, maybe not at that conference, but at another conference, a megachurch pastor talked about, we put golf carts in our parking lot to help people get into the door a little bit quicker. And so the pastor of a church of 2,000 is going like, oh, okay, I can do almost everything you said. We don't need golf carts, but I can do just about everything else you said. That's awesome. Meanwhile, the pastor of a church of 200 is going, you guys have a parking lot? Cool. We just try to keep the grass cut. Everybody parks out there, you know. Right? It's a big difference. And then if you're in a church of 50, it changes again. And then here's the weird deal. You can have two churches of 50. They can be in the same denomination, in the same town, on the same street, and you might as well be on two different planets. Why is that? Because they have 50 different people than they have. Now, I know the church of 2,000 here has 2,000 different people than the church of 2,000 here, but law of large numbers says there's more predictability between them than differences. In fact, that's even been shown in recent years, last 30 or 40 years, with the advent of the megachurch. There is more commonality among church size than there is among church denominations. If you go to two megachurches of different denominations, you will find more similarities than differences. But if you go to two churches of 50, same denomination, same town, same street, different planets. Why? Because this church has 50 different people. And this church here, when one family leaves, they say goodbye to their entire children's ministries department. They didn't just take all the workers, they took all the kids. Right? There's no megachurch that loses their head of their children's ministries department and goes, well, I guess we just have to shut the department down. No, just get another right person on the bus. Right? Just hire somebody else in. That's fine. And great. Right? Right? But and that's the way it is in this church. Whereas in this church of 50 over here, when that one person who we all love doesn't happen to show up for church on a particular Sunday, we all breathe a little bit easier because at least this week we're not going to have that awkward conversation in the church lobby. Don't any of you look at me like, I have no idea what you're talking about, Carl. All my people are perfect. I know that's not the case because I've been in your church. Oh, I haven't been in your church, but I've been in your church. And I know the rule. Here's the rule. You know what the rule is? Every church has been assigned one. And if your church doesn't have one, some other poor church has two. I don't make the rules, I just report them. So that church of 2,000 has one of those interesting folks as well, but that just means the pastor gets a weird email once a week. That's not a big deal. But in a church of 50, that one person can ruin your Sunday. That one person can split your church. That one person can drive a pastor out of ministry. We've seen it happen, haven't we? Yeah. That's why the small churches are weird. That's why there's that unique DNA fingerprint that we've got to adapt to in our church that's different from any other church. We've got to be aware of that. Now, the reason for the impact is because the reverse side of the law of large numbers, if the law of large numbers states that large groups behave predictably, the flip side of that coin is that the smaller the crowd is, the more impact each person has for good and for bad. So we just described some of the bad. Let me describe also for you some of the good. I want you to imagine that you play a little guitar. You're not great, but you can play a little guitar. You can keep up with a couple chords. And you go to the mega church I just described where they're singing songs from their latest album. You're going to sit in that audience. You're going to look at that stage and you're going to go, yeah, I'm never getting on that stage, am I? No, you're not. Wouldn't be good for them. Wouldn't be good for you. Wouldn't be good for the people who have to listen to it. Doesn't fit the context. But if you play a little guitar, not great, but you can keep up with the chords, and you show up to a church of 50, you're leading in worship in a month. In fact, if they find out you play guitar on your first visit, their first question will be, is your guitar in your car now? So I said earlier there were two primary reasons people say they go to small churches. Reason number one, the pastor knows my name. Reason number two, I can make a difference there. Studies have shown it over and over again. If they take one healthy church of 1,000 and 10 healthy churches of 100 and compare them, in the 10 healthy churches of 100, there's way more volunteers, there's way more per capita giving, there's way more people called into ministry. Why? Because more people can participate. You need 10 worship teams. You need 10 pastors. You need 10 people overseeing the youth department, the kids department, not just one with people who are volunteering underneath them. So you need it so out of necessity grows opportunity. And it's one of the primary reasons. So the two main reasons people say that I go to a small church, the pastor knows my name and I can make a difference there. So when we're trying to understand what quality looks like in a small church, start with those two things. Pastor, make sure you know their name. And secondly, give them opportunity to step up. We've been really blessed at our church over the years to watch as our youth, as our young people, as our adults who aren't quite great at it, get a chance to be on stage in front of people who know them and figure the instrument out in front of everybody. But it's amazing because they're going to be on stage on Sunday, they practice more and they get better quicker. Right? That's why music teachers do recitals. Because if the kid knows he's going to be playing in front of not just my parents, but everybody else's parents, hopefully they practice more. And the same thing happens on Sunday. We are a training ground for discipleship and for future ministers way more than our big church friends are. It's one of the advantages of the small church is we have the opportunity because we have the need that they don't necessarily have. So we got to understand that. We got to lean into that. The smaller the crowd is, the more impact each person has. Now let's take a look at some key differences between big and small as we come close to wrapping this up. Big church leadership tends to emphasize process, systems, and programs. And when I say emphasize, I don't mean that that's what's important in a big church. What I mean is if you sit in on a typical big church staff meeting, 90% of the conversation will involve processes and systems and programs. Why? Because when you've got an IKEA-sized church, you need arrows on the floor precision, and if you don't, it falls apart real fast. And then, one of the things I love about my big church friends, whenever they figure out a new way that makes stuff work, they don't trademark it. They get it out there and they tell everybody as quickly as possible, as free as possible, here's a better way to do church. The fact that it doesn't apply in your context is not a negative on them. They're just sharing what they've discovered and they're sharing it as quickly and freely as they can. And I'm really grateful to them for their generosity on that. Now, in small churches, processes and systems and programs are good, but they come in a distant second to three other things. Here's the three things that matter most in a small church. Small church leadership emphasizes relationships, culture, and history. Let me walk you through those three things because each one of those words matter a lot. First of all, relationships. Wait a minute, there we go. First of all, relationships. As I said earlier, the primary reason people go to small churches, pastor knows my name, I can make a difference there. There's a relational aspect to all of that. I have a podcast and I called it The Church Lobby. And the reason my podcast is called The Church Lobby is because I was trained how to do ministry from up here, from the stage. I was not trained how to do ministry in the church lobby. But the smaller the church is, the more important your church lobby ministry is. Like I heard from a big church, you know, podcaster a little while ago, and he talked about the importance of preaching and why it's important to preach, and you can't get hit a home run every Sunday, so you have got to have a preaching team, because you can maybe come up with 8 to 10 real bangers per year, but you can't come up with 50. So if you've got a preaching team of 5 or 6 and each one of them comes up with 8 to 10 bangers per year, then you've got a banger sermon every week, and that's important, because that Sunday morning preaching is the only time most of your congregation is going to see you. And he's right if you're pastoring 2,000 people. It doesn't work in 90% of churches under 200 who, one, can't hire a pastoral preaching staff, and two, the primary connection people make with you is not on a stage on a Sunday morning. The primary connection that people make with their small church pastor is in the lobby before and after the service. So we need to be aware of that, and we need to get better at our relational connectivity in the church lobby. And I'm speaking to my fellow introverts especially. As painful as it is to hear, you've got to spend more time face-to-face in the church lobby before and after the service. That's where they're going to make a greater connection to you and to their own need to grow in faith than they are from what you say on the stage. And I know that means your Sunday afternoon nap is going to be even more desperately needed for us introverts, because I am one of you, believe me on that. But I've had to learn the importance of the church lobby, because that's where relationships happen. So relationships, first of all. Secondly, culture. Culture is a big conversation among leaders in general over the last decade or so, and justifiably so. One of the sayings that they use is culture eats strategy for breakfast. And what they mean by that is, it doesn't matter how good your strategy is, if you're trying to do it in a bad culture, it will not work, no matter how good the strategy is. And we know this is true, because that's what Jesus' parable of the sower is all about. The seed is good on all four soils, but only one of the soils has a good culture. His parable of the sower is about culture. So you can have the greatest idea. It can literally be a vision given to you from God himself, and you try to do it in the church and it falls flat and you go, did I just miss it? No, you're probably trying to sow it into a bad culture. Culture, let me define culture for you. It's not on the screen, so I'll say it a couple times. As I'm referring to culture today, others have different definitions, but here's my working definition. Culture is the unwritten set of principles that governs everything a church does. Culture is the unwritten set of principles that governs everything a church does. So first of all, it's unwritten. You're not going to find your church's culture in your mission statement. You're not going to find it in your bylaws. It's unwritten. But it governs everything. Where will you discover your church culture? You'll discover your church culture when people do things like, we don't do it that way in our church. Or, that's just the way it is in our church. Those are statements of culture. In fact, the strongest culture enforcers in your church probably have no idea they're enforcing culture. Which makes it even harder to change if they don't even know it. We're just doing what we've always done. This is just the way it is here in our church. That's a statement of culture. So, in big churches, when they have the culture conversation, here's how it always, and I mean always, comes. Pastor, you set the culture in your church. Culture comes from the top down. So you make sure that your staff and your volunteers understand the culture, church culture. You preach on it, you teach on it, you live it, as you become an example of it, because the moment it dies in you, it'll die in everybody else. You, pastor, are the one who establishes and sets and preaches the culture in your church. You guide the culture in your church. It comes top down. And they are correct in a big church. But if you're a young new pastor and you go to an older small church and you walk in and you try to tell them what their culture is, God bless you at your next church. That is not going to fly. Why? Here's why. Pastors of pre-existing small churches don't set the culture. They inherit a culture. This is one of the biggest differences between big and small, and one of the reasons that one of the ways we need to filter what we hear from our big church friends. We don't set the culture, we inherit a culture. So you're thinking, oh, wait a minute, but as the pastor, do I just go along with what's happening? How do I move the culture? If it's a bad culture, how do I move it forward if I'm inheriting it? Well, there is a way you can do that. There's a simple three-step process. Let me walk you through it. Especially if you are new in a church. But at any time, here's the process by which you begin to move a culture of a church from bad to good or from good to better. Three steps. One, you have to know the current culture. Especially if you are new to a church, you show up as a student. The smaller the church is, the more of a student you need to be. Know the culture. Know what you're inheriting. The first job of a leader is to define reality. Define the reality that's sitting in front of you. Understand what's on your Apollo 13 table. Okay? Know the current culture. Step two, show them what you appreciate about their church's culture. If you show up to a church, even if it's toxic, even if it needs all kinds of fixing, but all you talk about is what they're doing wrong and how to do it better, you'll be dead in the water. It will not work. Because they're in that church because they like something about it. You got to find out what they like. And you've got to build a bridge to that. So understand the culture and then reflect back to them what you appreciate about the culture. In really some really difficult churches, the best thing you may find is, I love the way you used to do such and such. Find whatever you can that's positive and let them hear it coming from you and show a real appreciation for it, because they won't get where you're going until they get that you get them. If you can't show them that you get them, you've got no choice at all. So understand the culture. Show them what you appreciate about the culture, and then you will receive limited permission to participate with them in moving the culture forward. In the big church, culture flows from the top down. If I walk into a church of 1,000, I don't even expect to affect the culture of the church. I'm going to figure out what it is, and if I like it, I'll stay, and if I don't like it, I'll leave, but I ain't going to change it. But if I walk into a church of 20, I'm changing the culture just by being there, whether I want or not. There's an impact that everybody has. So there's always this back and forth. The smaller the church is, the more you work with the congregation members to help them understand what their culture is and move it forward. But those are the steps that you need to take in order to even have a chance with it. And then the last of the three is this: history. Small towns have long memories. And so do small churches. So if you are in a small church in a small town, you are doubly blessed. And we laugh at that, and understandably so, because we all know what goes with that often. But shouldn't that be a double blessing? Shouldn't a rich and deep history be a blessing? Shouldn't it be a foundation upon which we build? And why is it that a deep history so often feels like an anchor weighing us down rather than a foundation upon which we can build? So here's the deal. If you're dealing with a church and you're in a church that has a difficult history that is problematic for you, first thing I want to tell you is this: do not fight against your church's history. You will lose that fight. History has an unbeaten record. Why? Because it's already happened and there's nothing you can do about that. Do not fight history. You can't win. What do? Go deeper into it. Go deeper into it. As an example, in our church, we just celebrated our 60th anniversary in California. That's old. And as we were getting ready to celebrate it, actually, when we were back celebrating the 50th, we were finding some of the old documents, and I pulled out this. I found this, and I'd never seen it before. This was a newspaper article from the early 1960s with the awesome headline, "The Church Can Work with Delinquents." Now, if you're under 40, delinquent doesn't mean they're late in paying their bills. Back in the day when kids were making a mess in the community, we called them juvenile delinquents. Today, we call them terms like at-risk youth. That's probably better. But back then, we called them juvenile delinquents. And I found this article and I go, what is this article? And it's out on display that somebody pulled out from their old stuff from the church. And I start reading it. And take a look at this first paragraph. It's astonishing. As an institutional caseworker and probation officer, I searched for many months for a church really concerned about the needs of juvenile delinquents. Until recently, I could find none. This is an article written by a probation officer and caseworker who wants to help troubled youth and wants to work with churches to help troubled youth, and no church will step up to help them. Until, he says, I met this young man named Walter Price who's just planted this little church. And he says, we want to reach a new generation in a new way. We want to build a youth center. We want to build a kid center. We will work with you. We will help you. We want to reach troubled youth as well. And he goes on for 3 pages in the local newspaper about our founding pastor's vision for our church. So I took that photo. Because as I was standing there watching that photo, as close to me than that door is over there, in our very small parking lot, for the last 25 years, we have run the only skateboard park in our town. The reason was because 25 or so years ago, we resurfaced the parking lot, and the next day there was a bunch of noise outside, and I went out and there were skaters all over the place because we had the smoothest surface in town. And at that point, we realized we had an option. We can either buy a whole bunch of no skateboarding signs, or we can find some ramps. And we decided that churches on defense put up signs and churches on offense put up ramps. And so we put up ramps and we invited the kids. And for the last 25 years, we've run a skateboard park. And more kids have come to Christ through that skateboard park. And more of their parents have come to church and have come to Christ because their kids came to the skateboard park than maybe everything else that we've done combined in the last 25 years. There are people who are missionaries and pastors around the world today because they wanted a place to skate in our community. And we decided, let's go on offense and let's put the ramps up. So I took that photo because I thought, if anybody ever comes to me and goes, I can't believe you have a skateboard park in the holy place of a church parking lot. What would the founders of our church think if they knew kids were coming to church in skateboards with their hats on and wearing their hats in church? Oh, what would the founders think? If that ever happens, it never has yet. If that ever happens, I'm going to pull that out and go, I can tell you what the founders of our church would think. The church can work with delinquents. Now, not every skater is a delinquent, but it's a higher percentage, let me tell you. Because we've decided the best way to honor our founders. Don't do what your founders did. Think like your founders thought. Don't shy away from your history, go deeper into it. The problem with our history isn't that we go into it. The problem with our history is we don't go deep enough. If you go deep enough, you will find visionary statements from visionary people. You will not find, we're called to worship Jesus only on this color of carpet. No, you won't find that no. But you will find statements like, we're called to reach a new generation in a new way. You'll find visionary statements. And the way we honor our history is to think like they thought. Don't just try to duplicate what they did. And if we do that, we can move forward. I hope from this now you get some understanding of the differences between big and small. And I hope you now have somewhat of a filter to help you understand. As we're hearing from our big church friends, they're talking about pastoral absence. You have pastoral presence. They're talking about people who are highly skilled to be on stage. We're going to train them on the stage from the point of not being very skilled at all. People who are coming to our church, they want to be pastored by their pastor. Make sure you're leaning into that. Don't listen to the voices that say your church will be stunted in its growth if you try to pastor everybody. That's not true. Pastor biblically. Don't do everything for them, but pastor more biblically. But now that you have some of those things, as you now hear even from our big church friends, hopefully you'll be able to filter that to your context, not scale it down, but maybe have to switch it over to a totally different principle because of your size. I hope that's a help and a blessing to you. Thank you so much.